response to the kind of common media representation of the social sciences, which is to see the family as essentially, in modern societies, dysfunctional, falling apart, in a terrible mess. And yet most of you not only said that you were either quite happy or very happy, which is great, not bad, but you also said that family and friends were absolutely key to that. So I think it is quite important to have reaffirmed from time to time, even if only in a kind of superficial way, that some of our social institutions do actually work quite well. You know, there are problems, there's no reason to turn a blind eye to problems, but it's also important to recognise that actually, in this society, actually and in most societies in the world, social institutions do facilitate good lives, and they do work pretty well, and it's important to understand how they work well and what's the diversity. So I thought that was useful to have that thing. If you're interested in pursuing this, I was sufficiently interested by the responses on Monday to decide that I'm going to pursue this in a slightly risky way. I'm going to do a kind of a video box session at the USAID, the Edinburgh Students Association, a week on Wednesday. There's a lunchtime sort of general jamboree, all about stuff to do with teaching. And we're going to set up a video camera and ask people to say, what really matters in life? Yeah? Sound bites, video bites, if you like, of what really matters in life, and then explanations of why. Slightly tacky, but we're going to produce a short video in this that I hope will then be useful just to get discussions going in a variety of classes. If you want to take part, if you want to be in the video for posterity, come along, week and Wednesday. I'll remind you of that near the time. Now, one other thing I was going to tell you. Some very kind person emailed me today with a piece of information I didn't know, which was probably the most famous anthropological controversy, which is the controversy about Napoleon Chagnon's work on the Yanomama. Have any of you come across this controversy before? There's various controversies actually about his work, quite a controversial guy. He's not substantially included in my lectures, I don't know if you came across him at all last semester, but very, very famous now retired anthropologist from North America who, since the 1960s, studied a relatively remote forest dwelling tribe of people in Venezuela called the Yanomama, and became very controversial because people have alleged that he was part of a medical project that actually spread measles around the place. It wasn't entirely true. A few medical ethical codes infringed, perhaps, but nothing as serious as the allegations. But a really, really interesting video because it raises a lot of very, very important, a wide variety of anthropological debates. And it's on BBC iPlayer just now because it was shown on the TV a couple of nights ago. So if you're interested, go on the BBC iPlayer and key in Storyville, is the title of the program, Storyville. I thought really compelling viewing. I knew most of the content already, but it really, really compelling to see some of the old footage, some interviews, and it raises really, really compellingly passionate debates about why it is that people get so excited about their particular theory, their particular evaluations of certain kinds of fieldwork, certain ways of living. I'll come back to mentioning Chagnon again later when talking about romantic anthropology. So, let's now get into the slightly more substantial business. Whoops. That's what I wanted. Oh, I didn't want to do that again. Sorry, folks. Right. So, for today, I'm looking at the overall theme to kick off this course of Romanticism. And the storyline here that I want to start off with before you... Oh, sorry. No, wait. The pens are going down to paper. You generally, I really, really hope you don't need to take many notes in these classes. Free to if you like, but you don't need to copy down these. I will for every lecture, I promise this, and if I don't, remind me, tell me off, publicly humiliate me, I will put up all the slides that I use in the lectures on WebCT. And this one I've just put it up. Now, opinions from you welcome in this. Do come and complain to me after the lecture if you don't like this approach. My approach is to put them up either at the time of I've come across to the lecture or just afterwards. I don't like routinely putting them up in advance. So two reasons. One is, it's just possible while I cross George Square I might have brilliant ideas that I'll add into the lecture at the last minute. And the other thing is, at the risk of sounding patronising, I don't want you just being tempted into just thinking, well, the lectures are just the PowerPoints, and therefore I don't need to bother turning up. So if you really, really want me to whip them up in advance, then come and let me know, and I'll do that. But my general approach is, preference is to put them up on the day or the morning after, but not significantly beforehand. Okay, so the overall storyline here is that when I had the midlife crisis that I mentioned last session, and got halfway through my career, having worked on poverty and development and poverty alleviation and human rights and justice issues and so on, and then thought, I really actually want to look more positively at the goodness of life and at a better living in a more constructive way. Thought, right, well, I'll look back at anthropology again, go through the whole of the anthropological oeuvre, at our approaches, at the culture of anthropology, and see what anthropology has to tell us about the good life, and particularly about subjective experience of good life, or, to put it bluntly, happiness. So I asked the big question, what has anthropology, 100 years of anthropology, what's it actually taught us about happiness? And that's roughly 10 years since I asked myself that question, and I immediately, it was a kind of light bulb moment, and I started pestering colleagues and becoming an absolute pain, tapping people on the shoulder, said, can you tell me, what has anthropology told us about happiness? And I think generally that a lot of people giggled and thought it was silly and thought I was just off on a hobby horse and it was a fad and it would blow away. And it hasn't blown away. I'm still absolutely excited, but also enraged and frustrated, because I've found it really, really difficult to tell what my discipline, anthropology, has really brought to the world in terms of the understanding of happiness. And it's frustrating because, like many anthropologists, I think, I joined that. Because I thought there are some significant things wrong with modernity. There's alienating work, there's pollution, there's being overly serious about things, being too rushed. There's lots of things that aren't that great about modernity. Let's have a look around the world at different cultural formations and see if we can learn things about good life by looking at other cultures by immersing ourselves in them. So one of the reasons I became an anthropologist, implicitly at least, was to become happier myself and to learn about happiness around the world. And when I did my fieldwork with people, with forest people in southern India, just about my whole attention was on things to do with happiness, was to do with festivity and fun, creativity, autonomy, meaning making, and so on. I wasn't just there to do what the Standard Development Studies approach would have been, which is to study their poverty. They were objectively among the poorest people in the world. Hideous child mortality rates in the village for around 300 to 400 people where I was staying for a couple of years. Lots of children died. Lots of people my age at the time, mid-20s, died. Needless deaths, often just bad water supply, diarrhea, TB, tuberculosis was a huge killer. So there's lots of needless suffering. But poverty wasn't the only story that there was to be told about their lives. And despite all the objectively horrendous conditions, which did make me angry and made me want to do something about them, I was there to study their culture on their terms. And so I studied their happy celebrations, their festivities, the ways in which they made something of their lives, made their lives meaningful, and the ways in which they socially engaged. And so although I spent most of the rest of my career studying poverty, I always had this nagging feeling that actually just looking at poverty is never good enough. And there's something slightly dehumanizing about just looking at people from the perspective of victims of human rights or their poverty. Okay, so back to anthropology. Looking at the roots of anthropology, if you look at anthropology's antecedents in 19th century social philosophy and moral philosophy, the disciplines from which anthropology grew up. Were they interested in happiness in the 19th century, do you think? Any thoughts? Any of you studied the sort of post-Enlightenment moral philosophy era, any thoughts of whether happiness was a big thing then? Or was it just not even heard of? Anyone got any thoughts on that?
Well, by the 19th century, the priest kept on the last one.
Right.
Which basically took the view that the nature was not able, so there was no happiness.
Okay, rationalism. Can I just, do you mind if I just shout out at the rest of you? Rationalism was a big theme in the post-Enlightenment. One of the big Enlightenment projects was you would apply rational thinking to the problems of humanity and make the world better by applying reason rather than passion. However, you have a follow-up.
And
the other sense
is that a certain force of being human is one of them.
Yes.
It wasn't a rationalist. By the 19th century, essentially, most of the arguments were rationalist arguments.
Okay.
And then sociology and stuff followed on.
Right. Okay, so sociology and social sciences took off from moral philosophy, which was strongly informed by Enlightenment project and rationalism. But the other theme that is less well known, less richly commented on about the post-Enlightenment era, was that they were all, if you look at them, just about everybody said something about happiness, including David Hume, who just obsessively writing about happiness. So all the big names that led up to the formation of the modern social sciences in the 19th century, they all talked about happiness. And then the theme was silence, was dropped pretty much in the 20th century. Extraordinary if you look at it. I mean, of course it wasn't completely silenced. It was mentioned here and there, but it never became a prominent theme. And suffering and pathology has always been the prominent theme in most of the modern social sciences. Political science, psychology, sociology, all typically looking at social problems and social pathologies of modernity. Economics, slightly different. They stopped talking about happiness and started talking about utility and essentially made the ridiculous mistake of assuming that money, our purchasing power, is essentially an equivalent for knowing about people. If you know that people have got money, you know that they're happy, which is a dreadful mistake, and serious economists are realizing it was a terrible mistake. Anthropology, rather different again. It never developed a strong interest in happiness, but some of the founding fathers, like Malinowski, for example, repeatedly said, the point of going around the world to study non-Western cultures is to understand their happiness. And it was actually implicit in a great deal of anthropology was to look at the goodness of other people's lives, not to criticize, not to see them as poor and downtrodden, not to see them as backward, as lacking the trappings of modernity, or as lacking Christianity, or as lacking all the good things about modern civilization. It was to see them on their terms, respectfully, and to celebrate the goodness of their life. So the romantic anthropology theme that I want to emphasize today is that until the 1970s, there was a very, very dominant strain in anthropology, particularly in the anthropology of non-Western civilizations, which was a celebration of non-Western otherness, and to interpret those cultures in a romantic light, to see the good things about their society, to locate goodness, to locate innocence, to locate happiness in non-Western contexts, and especially in remote and simple non-Western contexts. So, to trivialize slightly, perhaps, my storyline for today is that 20th century anthropology never developed a serious, systematic attention to happiness, but it did attend to happiness in a very, very naive and romantic way. You were allowed to celebrate the happiness of non-Western peoples if you were going to criticize social formations, if you're going to criticize culture, and if you were Western, it had better be a Western society that you were criticizing. So the anthropologists that looked at Western culture, at businesses, at schools, bureaucratic organizations, they were pretty critical, but they wrote about unhappiness, not about happiness. Same goes for sociology. Sociologists overwhelmingly have written about unhappiness rather than about happiness throughout most of the 20th century. So, Romanticism in modern anthropology, common features of this, a kind of anti-establishment theme. We want to get away from the smugness of modernity to look at chaotic, natural, non-Western civilizations. We want to celebrate their simplicity, and often non-Western peoples were represented as if they were relatively natural. Underlining all of this was a theme of declinism, so the idea that Western civilization was in decline, and if you want to find social and cultural goodness, you'll find it in places that look a bit like the Garden of Eden. There's a kind of Christian background to this, that the idea that the fall of humanity expelled us from the Garden of Eden. If you want to find goodness, you go back to places that look a bit like the Garden of Eden, where people don't wear many clothes and where people appear to have relatively carefree existences. All of this, finally, was also underpinned by a critique of evolutionism. I don't mean by that a critique of the Darwinian science of evolution. I mean a critique of the cultural smugness that was derived, that built a very unscientific and very culturally biased theory out of Darwinian evolutionism, which is the idea that society, like biological complexity, society had become more complex and therefore was becoming more perfect, and that the most perfect models of civilization were to be found in the West. That's called social evolutionism. Nothing to do really with Darwinian scientific evolutionism, except that it grew up at around the same time and essentially borrowed metaphors from the scientific version. So anthropologists didn't like that because it was smug and it was racist. They wanted to get away from that, and they wanted to find goodness and beauty in non-Western civilizations where people appeared to be much more carefree and lived much more happy lives. So, all of that said, then, the core reading that I'm suggesting for you to read this week and discuss in the tutorial this week is undoubtedly, I think, the most famous essay ever written by an anthropologist, the original Afro of Society. Now, thank you to the person who pointed out that between when I submitted this and when the reading list went to press, the link for this article that's on the reading list doesn't actually work. The article, however, is available in full on the WebCT site, but also, as you should do with anything else after that, if you don't need you to find the link online, take a bit of the title, Google it, and you'll actually get there anyway. So it's just basically shifted, it's available in other locations. But it's such a famous essay, actually, that lots of people put it up online. So, the original affluent society. It was actually originally, I forget exactly when, it was originally a conference submission at a conference of hunter-gatherer studies in the mid-1960s, and then was published in Silas's collection of essays called Stone Age Economics in the mid-1970s, 1974, when that was So, Marshall Silas. Now, by the way, I want to make another tangential point here, if you don't mind me chipping in with a pen. I've started the practice of putting up pictures of the key thinkers that I've talked about. So I'll try whenever possible to have a picture of the person whose articles I'm using. It's several authors, I can't do it, it's too many. Sometimes I can't find a decent picture of them. But I would strongly recommend you to do similar. If you find somebody who is interesting to you, a writer, whether it's this or any other subject, try and find a picture of them, because you're much more likely to remember them, but also to humanize them, to think about them as a human being. Silence, very cool, dapper figure, very, very influential, brilliant writer, no doubt about it, absolutely fantastic prose, which is not always the case in anthropology or in the social sciences in general. Really had a gift for rhetoric, for very clever phrases, humorous. It's energizing. So in lots of ways, I really, really recommend this essay. I certainly, when I just about every introductory course in anthropology would have this essay on it. I don't think it's the case anymore today. It's some people have got slightly bored with it. It's also, in some ways, quite seriously discredited, and I'll come to that in a minute. But it's a captivating, motivating article, and the passion with which he writes is a passion driven by this core idea that was dominant in anthropology really until well after he wrote this essay, which is we need to get away from the idea that non-Western, simple cultures are somehow inferior, and that the simplicity leads to objectively low standards of living. What he's trying to argue is that it's quite possible that if we reinterpret and reevaluate hunter-gatherer societies without that smug social evolutionist lens on, if we actually evaluate them on their own terms, then instead of looking at the poverty and the deprivation, and instead of assuming them to be starving, we'll actually recognize that there's lots of things that are not just morally admirable, but are also delightful and enviable about their lives. So this rhetorical phrase, in his rhetorical phrase, they are the original affluent society. So he's asking us to look at hunter-gatherers, then look back at Western civilization and have a conversation about what affluence or prosperity or the good life really means to us. It's one of the bravest anthropological articles because most anthropologists aren't as explicitly tub-thumping or evaluative as that. So another thing, apart from the fact that he writes beautifully, I like the fact that he's honestly trying to be evaluative. Yeah? So part of my argument for this course is, yes, what's the point of doing social science if you're not going to try, to some extent, to evaluate? With the proviso that when we evaluate, we shouldn't just do so using only our own cultural lens. That would be ethnocentric. We need to try and get away from that. And he's doing that. He's saying, all right, so my North American cultural lens is that affluence is all about money and material prosperity and about technological progress. I'm stepping out of that, looking at hunter-gatherer societies. They're affluent in quite a different way. So here's a picture of a Hadza hunter-gatherer child in Tanzania. I'll show you in a minute a picture of one of the anthropologists who's studied with them. But one of the hunter-gatherer case studies from which he draws his data. He's looking at several hunter-gatherer communities around the world and synthesizing the evidence. Have a look at this picture. What does it make you think? What does it suggest to you? What does it make you feel? Do you want to talk to a neighbour about that for a second? Stop and talk to a neighbour for a second, and then we'll ask for some questions. A quick chance, but it has to be quite a quick chance. Any thoughts on what this, you're looking at a picture like this, what does it make you think of? What does it make you feel? Does it start making you start evaluating that society in some way? Any thoughts on that?
Aboriginalism.
Hello, sorry?
Aboriginalism.
Aboriginalism? Well, right. Yeah. So there's a sort of, the sense of purity or?
Primitive.
Yeah, so it looks, so the person is quite primitive? Yeah. Any other thoughts? Does anyone know the technical issue that's going on here with that distended stomach? I don't know, I'm not a medic, but certainly when I was working in India, very often people looked at the distended stomach like that and said, kwashiorkor, or it could have been parasites. This is very unlikely to be a well-nourished child. However, having said that, to be fair, the evidence of hunter-gatherer societies around the world very often suggests that they're not any worse nourished than agricultural people in neighbouring communities. But it doesn't look like a particularly well nourished child. Any other thoughts about the picture? So does that make you feel good?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's something enviable. The freedom. I mean, it's a beautiful picture, I think. The freedom, the excitement, it makes you worry about our own children being cooped up in urban environments, being made to sit in schools all day long. And another thing about it is that there's a child that's using a bow and arrow. They don't say anything about a bow and arrow.
He's learning how to eat.
Sorry?
Kids learning how to eat.
Learning how to sort of the practical function. Anything else about the bow and arrow?
It's a work tool. He's working.
Okay, so quite well, so a child labourer.
does a child exist?
Yeah, so exactly. We'll come back to this. We'll think about this again when we look at the life stage stuff and the idea of the life stage of the child. Clearly, what's going on here is very, very young children are beginning to engage in the meaningful livelihood activities of the culture. So there's lots of things to admire and to envy about the picture. But a health and safety officer was saying, well, for goodness sake, not only, this child's not only got a bow and arrow, which might have a poison tip, you know, but look, you know, there's quite a serious fall. So there are things to worry about there too. Anyway, I suppose the general point is, it's very, very tempting, I think, just to get excited about the romantic image of the hunter-gatherer, but and it's very hard at the same time to entertain serious thoughts about about the kinds of quality of life, the human rights of the child, and so on. Moral questions that I think we do need to ask. And coming along, this is just another couple more pictures of Hadza people. There's Jim Woodburn. Isn't that a classic anthropologist? We've had a few in our department that look a bit like that. Jim Woodburn, English anthropologist who worked for many years among the Hadza in the 1950s and 60s, and from whose work Silence bases a considerable amount of his conclusions. So, most famous anthropology. It's an absolute classic. One point about it is, I've said it's evaluative, but it's also evaluative not just about hunter-gatherer society, saying hunter-gatherer society is good, it's a picture of affluence, but it's also at the same time evaluative of his own cultural context. It's an evaluation, his essay is not just about hunter-gatherers, it's an evaluation of capitalism. So capitalism is the target, and he's attacking the evolutionist assumption that the Neolithic revolution, i.e. the technological change from hunter-gatherer society to farming and storing, which then led to the Industrial Revolution. Essentially, he's arguing this is we should not assume that this has been a good thing. And that is a classic romantic approach. And I haven't, to say that he's entirely wrong. But I have also to say that if we're going to have a grown-up moral anthropology that evaluates, the argument of today is we need to be an awful lot more serious about the ethical evaluation and about the systematic scrutiny of what's good and what's bad about society than silence was. I love the essay because it's inspiring, it's passionate, it's evaluative, but it's nowhere near good enough. And sometimes, if I'm in a bad mood, I think it's one of the most morally repugnant essays ever written as well. Because he's absolutely naively celebrating the goodness of a way of living that costs enormous amounts of unnecessary suffering. People that he's writing about, whose lives he's celebrating, they generally didn't get to live much beyond 30 most of the time, as child mortality rates of 50%. Now, as a parent of three kids, I don't like the idea of children dying unnecessary deaths. I saw it a lot when I was in India. I didn't like it much. And to sort of gloss over that in the way that he does, I think you'll find it quite disturbing. And I would like you to discuss that in your tutorials, as well as, of course, the other moral issues that he raises about cultural relativism and about evaluation. So there are issues here worth discussing to do with evolution and progress. What does it mean to progress? There are issues to do with livelihoods. He celebrates their livelihood. It's a good livelihood, he says. They don't have to work very hard. They've got tremendous freedom. Children learn the livelihood skills from an early age, so there isn't that separation of work and leisure that arguably is a cause of a great deal of anxiety and suffering in modern society. He's arguing that they do this from a position of choice. There's an argument here about voluntary simplicity. Remember, he was writing in the 1960s. It was really towards the end of the 60s that what has now become essentially a global movement, the voluntary simplicity movement, was really beginning to take off. Went quiet a bit in the 1980s, back again now with a vengeance. The idea that we should rethink our ways of living by choosing, where possible, to live more simply than we have done. And there's lots in there. There's arguments about food security, about what it means to work and how good it is to spend a great deal of time working. And there's arguments about what it means to be affluent versus what it means to be poor. The overall argument, I won't dwell too much on all these details because you'll get it from the essay and you can discuss it again in your tutorials. Essentially, he's arguing that the original affluent society was one in which people's material wants were easily satisfied. So this, I do want to emphasize, it's absolutely core to his argument, is that these people choose simplicity. They choose to limit their wants to the kinds of want that can be satisfied immediately in their immediate environment without going out and developing complex technologies, without storing, and without relying on large numbers of other people. They might have small hunting teams, they might have a very minor division of labour in men choosing to hunt big game, women and children hunting small game, and so on. But essentially, there's very little social dependence, there's almost no storage, and therefore there's high mobility and tremendous freedom. And so if we interpret affluence as being able to satisfy your wants, then interpret as that, he appears to be right. If that's all that they want, they appear to be very, very affluent, the people that he's writing about. And so he pulls no punches. He says, by contrast, modern life is a tragedy of endless work, chasing unlimited wants. Capitalism has sentenced us to a life at hard labour. It's a familiar argument, but at the time, coming from anthropology and sustained with anthropological images and anthropological case studies, it was a very punchy article, and you'll very often find it, therefore, quoted in texts on voluntary simplicity, quoted in critiques of capitalism. The Galbraithian way, named after Kenneth Galbraith, the North American economic critic of capitalism, is as Silence puts it, to aim for affluence. It's actually slightly confusing, this part of his essay, by the way, those of you who are interested in Kenneth Galbraith. Kenneth Galbraith was by no means a champion of capitalism. And his book, The Affluent Society, from which this essay borrows its title, was actually a major critique of just exactly the kind of things that Silence is himself critiquing. The other confusing thing about it is, you'll see this phrase used in a sort of rather glib way, that the hunter-gatherers choose the Zen road to affluence. Now, what's the Zen road to affluence?
Zen means meditation.
Zen, we associate Zen with meditation. Any other aspects of Zen? I'm not a specialist in Zen, but any other aspects of Zen culture that he might have had in mind?
Want what you've got rather than striving to get something different.
Okay, yep.
Be satisfied.
There's a major plank of Zen Buddhist discourse, which is sorting out your head by not aspiring for things that you can't have, by not even aspiring for things that you could have, by limiting your wants, by limiting your aspirations, being happy with the moment. Now, so there is clearly something. There's a message here at the time that voluntary simplifiers in North America were getting interested in Eastern or various non-Western philosophies, he's saying there's an analogy here between what the hunter-gatherers already do and what the Zen masters have made into a religion. To that extent, the analogy is fine. It's thought-provoking. It's at least tentatively a kind of cross-cultural comparison. But I think it's too glib, and it's potentially puzzling, because crucial difference is that Zen and other major world religious philosophies tend to be developed by educated, rich, comfortable elites. People who can afford to choose simplicity because they've already enjoyed the comfortable, rich life. And the assumption that hunter-gatherers are as free as the Zen Buddhists that invented that religious doctrine, I think is a dangerous one. And other anthropologists of a more Marxist persuasion, although Salins himself, he thought he was a Marxist, other anthropologists have put a kind of class interpretation on hunter-gatherers, on modern hunter-gatherers, and said, actually, these are much more of better interpreted as an underclass, who haven't chosen their position, who have to live in the most remote environments because they can't get on in agricultural society. They've been denied land, they've been denied access to resources and education and so on. They're essentially an underclass. And so there's something slightly, potentially rather conservative about this idea that they're like Buddhist, the hunter-gatherers are like Buddhists. Something slightly naive about it. Various other things I've just mentioned pretty briefly. he's saying that their prodigality, that the fact they don't appear to save possessions, they don't appear to save it, they appear quite wasteful with their food. All of that's to do with the doctrine of limiting their wants, of consuming immediately, and not trying to delay gratification. So they could store if they wanted to, but they choose not to because they know that storage leads down the slippery slope to social inequalities and dependencies. And so he's putting a kind of environmental spin on this as well. But as I said in my criticisms already, he does very much downplay, I think he exaggerates their freedom, he downplays their ill health, and so in general portrays them as somehow better off than they actually are. He doesn't deny that they live in material poverty. He agrees that their objective conditions look often pretty bad, but he romanticizes that by assuming that they choose all this kind of simplicity. So there's a question mark over whether it really is a matter of choice and principle for them to maintain so few possessions. The example of sleep is another one. He's pretty admiring of them for getting lots of daytime sleep. Now, I'm a great fan of daytime sleep. I love a lunchtime nap. I think it's very good. In fact, a really good health tip for all of you, if you don't do this already, give yourself a lunchtime nap. But the Kalahari Bushmen and the Hadza that he's writing about, they sleep for 3 or 4 hours in the afternoon. Now, is that good, or is it because they're bored? You know, it's an open question. Is it really that good to have so much leisure time that you spend half the day sleeping? He was clearly very envious of them, but I'm not sure that that's what the good life is is really about when there are so many other exciting things to do in the world. And in terms of moral evaluation, he shrugs off the really, really nasty things about hunter-gatherer society in I think, rather shocking and essentially in rather chilling ways. He kind of shrugs off, well, okay, hunter-gatherers do occasionally need to kill their babies, and sometimes they kill old people if they're to remain mobile. He kind of shrugs that off as if it just doesn't matter. And here's this phrase that I find that really, really gets up my nose, that they're obliged to handle people and goods in parallel ways. What he means by that is, and he himself admits that's cold-blooded, what he means by that is they kill babies and old people. And actually, at the time he was writing, there were lots of other romantic anthropologists describing hunter-gatherer as the peaceful people, the lovely, you know, lovely, cuddly, Mbuti pygmies. Colin Turnbull wrote about them. They were basically all written about as if everything about them was lovely. Actually, many of the people that Silens is writing about in this essay, when people have gone back and actually assessed levels of violence, homicide, and so on, they found they had higher rates of killing than was pertaining in New York in the 1960s at the time that he was writing. So he tries to sort of cover his back. He says, I don't deny that they have moments of difficulty, but that is such a grotesque understatement for a society where half of the children die, and where sometimes old people have to be not just left by the left to fend for themselves, but actually sometimes killed off. So I want you to make up your own minds about this. Enjoy it for what's good about it, but please try not to be as naive as some people have about it in seeing it as a form of evaluation of different ways of being. And if you want to look at some follow-up studies of this, I won't go into all these in all detail, but Richard Lee, a key figure in the study of hunter-gatherer societies, his work on the Zhu Huanzi, I've recommended that as secondary reading. I won't go through all my notes on this, but you can look at this on the web. And for a really stinging critique of Silens, the reading by Kaplan, actually providing some evidence that contradicts some of the arguments that Silens puts forward. As I say, all of this up there on the website if you want to follow it up. Okay, so for next Monday, we'll go into a slightly more theoretical topic of looking at the anthropology and psychology of the individual, the position of the individual, and how the individual is identified in anthropological study. Oh, yeah.